Hello, welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. This is Christopher Bandini. I'm going to be speaking today to Dan Shaw, who is the author of Traumatic Narcissism. Dan Shaw is a psychoanalyst and a trained psychoanalyst and psychotherapist working in New York City. He currently serves on the faculty of the Westchester Center for the Study of Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy and at the National Institute for the Psychotherapies as a teacher and supervisor of psychoanalytic candidates, and was co-chair of the Continuing Education Committee of the International Association for Relational Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy, IARP for short, for several years. His book, Traumatic Narcissism, Relational Systems of Subjugation, was published in 2014 by Routledge for Relational Perspective Series, and we're going to be speaking to him today about that book. So welcome, Dan Shaw.
Thank you, Chris.
What we usually do, Dan, is we speak about the we ask you what led you to write this book.
Well, a couple of things. I've been writing on the theme of narcissism for a while, excuse me, but mainly in a couple of papers that a couple of book reviews that were in Contemporary Psychoanalysis. And in a paper that was published in Psychoanalytic Dialogues called Enter Ghosts. What led me to write the book was that I was talking to Lou Aaron, the editor of the Relational Perspective series, about my paper and about his anthology of relational papers. And I was wondering where a place for it might be, the Enter Ghost paper. And he was saying, well, we might not have an anthology out for a while, but you could go ahead and write a book. And I was taken aback. I was at first saying, I don't think so. But I quickly realized what an amazing opportunity that would be. Lou Aaron had been familiar with my writing from a group writing class that he had held privately that I was in. So I took all my old papers and I put together an outline that would include some of the material from those writings and some new material. And Routledge agreed, and off we went. Now, what inspired me to be interested in this topic from the get-go was a long, more than a decade-long experience I had as a full-time worker in a religious organization, which I later eventually came to see as cultic, as authoritarian and abusive. And I became very interested in the charismatic leaders of groups like this and the followers, people like myself and the many others that I knew. And it's really from that experience that I began to be interested in the topic. It pretty quickly became clear to me that I was looking at narcissism. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll just say a little more about this because I don't want to spend the whole talk on this one question. But specifically, what I came to feel was that I wasn't satisfied with the psychoanalytic explanations of narcissism, because I felt they were very broad and they often seemed to talk about an innate character problem. And I saw narcissism as most relevant to a relationship in which a particularly narcissistic person would be controlling and dominating and subjugating of another person. And you know, Alice Miller wrote about this in Drama of the Gifted Child, about the narcissist parent and the child of the narcissistic parent. I saw that relationship as a slightly different way of thinking about narcissism as a relational system in which one person allowed themselves to be subjugated by a person who desired and needed to subjugate others. So that all flowed from my cult experience. It also flowed from working with people whose parents were extremely narcissistic, and looking at them as adult children of these kinds of narcissists, learning about their struggles and their problems, and that was really the inspiration, those different things.
Yes, I think that's something that's so unique about the book is the is this take on it. It almost turns it totally around on its head from the conventional ways of looking at narcissism, almost like, as you were saying, this characterological or kind of internal process, but rather that it's this relational process, and that the this need for authority, this need for subjugation is really a very vital component to both the person who, I guess, already is the narcissist and the development in the young person or the child of narcissism.
That's right. Exactly. That there is really a subjugator and a subjugated one, and that they form a system. And that's what I wanted to try to really elaborate in the book. In different contexts, you know, first as a parent-child developmental situation, but then later in married couples or partners, in teacher-student relationships, in therapist-patient relationships, and in group relationships as well. So I wanted to try to capture the essence of this dynamic, this subjugator-subjugated dynamic.
Maybe it would be interesting to go into some of the examples of, you know, how it occurs, say, in a parent-child relationship as versus a therapist-patient relationship. What are the similarities,
sure,
and what are some of the differences?
Okay. Well, developmentally, so let's say we can identify, you know, usually we're talking to patients and we hear about parents, and if we're listening carefully enough, we'll hear whether or not this parent was good enough, sane enough, or whether the parent really suffered from a significant personality disorder. And when the parent is, you know, somebody who sounds very much like the classic narcissist, it's important to, for me then, at least, to start to think about the impact of that behavior on the developing child. And I think most of us are familiar with that concept, and we recognize the idea of a narcissistic parent who essentially doesn't want to validate or recognize the separate subjectivity of their child. And the child is conditionally loved on the basis of how well the child accommodates to the narcissistic parent. Okay, so I think that's not an unfamiliar concept for most therapists. The way I see that emerging over time in the whole of development for the child is in several ways. The parent, the essence of the narcissistic relationship in this case in development is that the parent needs to always feel in control and in some ways is always feeling threatened by the possibility of another being separate. Okay, so the narcissist parent is a profoundly dependent person who wants to disavow and deny their dependence. Now, a child is born completely dependent, right? And has no choice but to be dependent. What the narcissist parent wants, unknowingly, unconsciously, is for the child to feel unusually dependent to the extent that the parent will have total control over the child. And this parent does not want to see the child develop and differentiate and individuate, because that means that the child gains independence and gains a sense of their own subjectivity and their own separate validity as a person. The narcissist parent can't tolerate that, and wants the child to understand. You know, I've called this kind of parent, based on Fairbairn's work, a person who employs the complementary moral defense. So let me explain that for a little bit. You know, we know about Fairbairn's idea of the moral defense, wherein the child of a bad parent takes on the burden of the badness and feels himself to be bad so as to preserve a fantasy of a good parent, because that's a more secure situation than for the child to feel innocent and recognize they have a bad parent. When you're completely dependent, and you're not the guilty one, the parent is, what do? You have no place to go with that. So if you make yourself bad, employing what Fairbairn termed the moral defense, and you can preserve the parent as good, and you can have some hope that you could find a way not to be bad so that the parent will love you. Okay. Now, this parent, in my view, is employing a complementary moral defense. In other words, that parent is claiming all the goodness and disavowing any badness. So the child is taking the burden of all the badness on itself. The parent is taking all the goodness. It's a complementary situation.
The goodness of the child.
The goodness of the moral goodness. Not just the goodness of the child, but the parent is saying, all your goodness comes from me, and if you don't acknowledge that, that's your badness. But just the moral goodness. The parent believes in their own perfection. The narcissist is a person who is always viewing themselves as superior and perfect, including in a righteous way. They're right, and if something's wrong, it's the other person who's wrong. This is the nature of any personality disorder. The personality disordered person believes in the absolute rightness of their own way of being, and if something's wrong, it's the other person who's wrong. So the parent takes all the goodness unto himself. I'm always right. I'm always good. When there's a problem, it's because you're bad. And this, the parent, in other words, coerces the child into employing the moral defense that Fairbairn describes. So that's a little bit of a different take on Fairbairn's idea. I just think it fills it out. It talks about both sides of that relationship. So the narcissist parent has claimed all the goodness, all the rightness, all the righteousness. Anything that's wrong is the child's fault. And what the narcissist parent can't bear is the child's separate subjectivity. The narcissist parent wants to be in control of the reality. And if the child's reality differs, the narcissist parent invalidates the child's reality. So the child learns, as Winnicott said, to accommodate, or as Bernard Branchap says, to pathologically accommodate to the parent. But it's the parent that's pathological here. That's my point. And there are pathological parents. Some people get upset. Why are we bashing parents? Well, some parents are extremely abusive and destructive, not merely through violence or sexual acting out, but through invalidating and non-recognition of the child's separate subjectivity. That's an act of violence, in my view. And so this child has a choice when they grow up. Not really a choice. They tend to go into one of two directions. One, they refuse to accept the badness. At least they consciously say, no, I'm not the bad one. And in defending themselves in that way, kind of like a manic defense, they can become the next traumatizing narcissist. They will then want to subjugate others. The other way the child can go is to accept the subjugation and to accept all the badness and to live a life of depressive guilt. And to feel essentially that they, you know, that no matter how they may try to be good, they always end up unworthy and bad. So some of our patients who are children of traumatizing narcissists, I think most of the patients we see who have had these parents are those depressive ones who at their core cannot hold on to any faith in themselves as good. And that's the way that they have been traumatized by the narcissist. So that's an attempt at a simplified version of the developmental piece of this theory.
Yes, and how much of it do you think is conscious on the part of the parent, and how much is a kind of an unconscious enactment?
I think that the parent in this case, as with all the personality disorders, essentially has a delusional perception of themselves as perfect, as righteous, as correct. And this is really why, for me, the concept of the personality disorder, which many of us feel is pathologizing and therefore try not to think about, I'm afraid that it's a very good concept when you're thinking about abusive people who are abusive, because some of those people might be psychopaths and they may consciously feel that they're entitled to criminal behavior or behavior. But next in line are the narcissists and the others, and they believe in their own righteousness. They believe that everything they're doing is for the moral right, and that when they're cruel, it's because that's what's morally right. When they're abusive, when they're belittling or humiliating or intimidating, that's because that's the morally correct way to treat the other person. They truly believe that. And in my view, it's a delusion. It's a delusion of omnipotence. And, this is something we do read about from Winnicott and from Jessica Benjamin's work especially.
Right, you bring up the do or done
yes,
too.
Yes, exactly. And that, that there is a problem with not having matured in a way that allows omnipotence to fade into a sense of having one's own power. If it doesn't mature in that way and it remains, omnipotence is a pathological, I think, a delusion. And it means then that I have the right to, for my subjectivity, to be the only valid one. And anybody who questions it is a bad person.
I'm thinking how much it also sounds like Eric Fromm's concepts of authoritarianism and the escape from freedom and somebody's submission, right? Also, to use Manny Gantz's surrender submission in
yes.
the sense that the person in the powerless position gives up their power to someone who is righteous or kind of all knowing
yes.
or kind of puts out this kind of I guess in a sense a charisma too. Is
absolutely
part of
this. I'm very influenced by Eric Fromm's work, and I cite it quite a bit in the book. I think Eric Fromm really did work very hard at understanding what he termed malignant narcissism, and he saw it at the nationalism level and at the individual level, and he wrote about both. I'm very influenced by that. The reason I do think that kind of narcissism is malignant in that it attempts to control and destroy the independent subjectivity of another or of others by a system of subjugation. But he also did, as you say, describe the propensity, the human propensity to regress to a place of idealization and dependence in which you long to give over all your power to an all-powerful leader who represents strength and power and goodness. And if you follow that leader, then you, that may be a way, by giving up your freedom and following that leader, that may be a way to lose the sense of not being good enough or to lose a sense of impotence. Certainly, this is what Fromm thought was going on for the German people in the way that they followed Hitler. You know, it's a joke kind of on the internet that sooner or later every discussion references Hitler. So I hate to be, you know, part of the joke, but certainly this was Fromm's concern as a Jew and as a European to, you know, to watch in horror that a whole nation could subjugate themselves to an insane, delusional leader. Now, they didn't think he was insane or delusional, nor did Hitler think so. They thought that they were absolutely the master race. The highest possible choices were being made, the most righteous, the most, you know, Robert J. Lifton wrote a book called Destroying the World to Save It, about the Japanese guru Om Shinrikyo. But the same applied in Nazi Germany. This was the plan. We're going to destroy this one race so that this master race can rightfully take its place and the world can be purified. But this is also, by the way, what happened in chapter 3 of my book. I write about a psychotherapy cult that was quite notorious in New York for many years.
Yes, the Sullivanians.
The Sullivanians, the people who ran the Sullivan Institute, which I always am careful to say in no way was or is connected to the White Institute. Even though Sullivan was at the White Institute, this was a complete split-off, non-related institute run in the city as a communal, as a psychotherapy commune. And it was run along the same lines as Fromm described, you know, very successful, well-educated people took orders from their therapists, and the therapists took orders from the top therapists, and the orders were very specific about how to live, what to wear, where to go, who to sleep with, and basically the commands were to sleep with as many different people as possible, how to be a parent, which meant give your children away to somebody else to raise because you're going to destroy them and create a neurotic child if you try to be their parent. So small children were sent off to boarding schools or given to other people in the commune to be raised and separate from their parents. I mean, the degree of control of the leaders was extraordinary. And the degree of sexual boundary violations and other ethical violations was extraordinary. And this was all happening in New York City in the 60s, 70s, 80s. It finally died off in the 90s when the main leaders died. But it's a perfect example of the relational system of the traumatizing narcissist, in this case, in a large group.
Yeah, well, I think this idea of the traumatizing narcissist is so central because the after effects of being involved in this kind of what I'll call a narcissistic dyad, for want of a better term, is kind of leaves so much in its wake in terms of the trauma that and that's continuing. I think you speak to this in the book in terms of dissociation.
Exactly,
as well.
It is like any other kind of relational trauma. The outcome is always you know. A tremendous degree of dissociation. Now, even more, to be more specific about what the trauma for the follower is, for me, it's the abdication they have to abdicate their own subjectivity. They have to disclaim and even despise their own subjectivity and replace it with the by being the person that they are commanded to be by the narcissist. Now, the narcissist, if the narcissist were, I suppose, a saint, perhaps, maybe that would be helpful to people who follow. They would perhaps find themselves in deep ways and be themselves. But the narcissist doesn't want other people to be themselves. The narcissist wants them to be subjugated to him or her. The narcissist wants them to live in such a way that the only thing they concern themselves with is whether or not they are pleasing the narcissist. And to live that way, to abdicate your own subjectivity, may feel as though it's voluntary. Certainly, you know, people who work with domestic violence or with abused children have seen that battered wives or abused children very frequently feel like the last thing they want to do is leave the abuser. They feel like they're there voluntarily. They feel like the abuse isn't so bad. They'll minimize it. They'll claim the abuse is really their fault. And this is another example of what I would call the traumatizing narcissist relational system. Absolutely. So the trauma is both the loss of one's own subjectivity, one's own sense of oneself as a separate, valid person, and the loss of the ability to have intersubjective relationships, by which I mean relationships in which both persons are allowed to exist as separate, valid subjects, and one person isn't being made the object of the other. Again, this is very based in Jessica Benjamin's work, as best as I understand it, and you know, in which she describes the relationship of do or done to the breakdown of intersubjectivity, and that is what that breakdown of intersubjective relatedness and being made to live a life in which you always have to see yourself as below the other person. That's traumatic, and we see patients who there's another aspect to this which I also would credit Sheldon Bach for really elaborating in his work, and also Lou Aaron in certain papers. You know, where we see people who seem to not be able to feel themselves as a fully subjective being. They seem to themselves as the object of others. And I try to give some examples of this in the book of adult children of traumatizing narcissists who, for example, go out on a date, and the only concern they have is how to make the other person feel good and like them. They are unable to identify whether or not they actually like that person because they're just viewing themselves as serving as an object for the other person, so that the other person is supposed to, they're supposed to figure out what does that person want to hear and what do they want to think and how do they want to feel and how do I deliver that. They don't think about what I want and what I feel and what I believe.
Yes, you have some wonderful examples in the book about how you work with the, I guess, the development of this subjectivity, and also your use of yourself in bringing this about, and how, and some very dramatic transformation.
Yeah, well,
part of the book.
There's been some successful work there for sure, and there are also times when I have been, very disappointed and not being able to allow. For example, I'll start with an example of disappointment that I use in the book. A woman who came to see me, a young woman who was living with her boyfriend, who was a very strong, big cop and very dominating. And she was a very tiny petite woman and very submissive. And when she came to see me, she could barely speak without crying and choking on her tears. And it seemed as though anything she tried to say to her boyfriend always led her to start to cry and start to, be unable to speak. And I began to try to help her with her fear and work with her on what it was she was trying to say, and giving her ideas about how she could try to bring out her thoughts and feelings more clearly and engage in a dialogue rather than always collapsing in a kind of resignation to letting the other person have their way. So that seemed to be developing as we worked together. But then we ran into a hitch. She was describing growing up with parents who were very punitive, very moralistic, very religious, and very punitive of what they saw as immoral behavior, which usually was, the kid not being respectful or polite enough. And she and her sister would be sat down on a piano bench, the parents seated at a table before them. They would be asked to say what they did wrong and spell it out in detail. And then if it were a lesser offense, they would be made to hold a bar of soap in their mouth. And then she told me that when it was a more serious offense and the parents were angrier, they were made to hold liquid soap in their mouths. So I was aghast at this. I was aghast. I didn't want to give too much away, but I couldn't help it. And I at some point said, is that something you think you might? I said, do you think that was abusive? And she seemed to be defending the parents. And I said, well, do you think it's something you would do to your own child? She said, maybe I would. So I was a little taken aback, and I we were toward the end of a session there, and we ended. And I later heard from her by email that all of a sudden there was too much going on at work and she would not be able to return. And I made many efforts to reach out to her and try to speak with her about that and email and so on, and to no avail. And my feeling was that the indoctrination she had received into the authoritarian way of being, where somebody is stronger and more right and somebody else submits, that was just a paradigm that wasn't going to shift so easily for her. And certainly she was going to leave me before she was going to leave the dominating boyfriend, or before she was going to recognize the parents' behavior as in any way abusive. So that was an example of a disappointment in the work. But, there are good examples as well that are very gratifying, clearly, because it really is like, it's a very difficult transformation to make. If you've been used to being, I like Brian Chapp's phrase, pathologically accommodating all your life, so that you almost can't even know your own desire or your own, and certainly don't feel like you have your own agency, because everything is dependent on the other. It's very difficult to imagine another way of being. And I'll talk to somebody and I'll say, well, what was that like for you when you were with your family? And they'll say, well, my wife thought it was really this and that. And I'll say, oh, that's what your wife thought. I was wondering what you thought. Well, I think we felt it was so and so. In other words, that person doesn't feel somehow in touch with their own internal experience, and the experience is articulated only through someone else's framework. So I'll note that, for example, is one of the things that'll happen. I'll say, you seem not to be able to feel comfortable just to say, well, I feel such and such. And sometimes I'll hear, I guess I don't know what I feel. Or did you like that girl you dated? Well, I think she liked me, will be the answer. I say, yeah, but did you like her? And, I'll say, wow, it's like you don't know how you feel. All you can focus on, it seems, is what they might be feeling. And that, and little by little, we'll begin to talk about the ways in which, this is a kind of self-objectification. And very typically, we'll find in the background, developmentally, a very narcissistic parent whose control of the subjectivity was so great that it was the only subjectivity exists in the other person. And that patient before me only knows himself as the object of the other. Now, I don't know if that gets into the kinds of examples you were mentioning.
I think it just – what struck me as I was reading the book was how different that seems than the more typical sense of narcissism that we have, where someone feels so entitled or that the rules don't apply to them, in a sense that almost like an intense self-involvement, almost like that it feels like they know so much what they want to the exclusion of
knowing anyone. That person might be the traumatizing narcissist, the one who gets into a relationship in which they traumatize the other person by subjugating them, by stripping them of their subjectivity, and by dominating and controlling the subjectivity in the relationship. So yes, that narcissist, that grandiose, inflated, entitled narcissist is by all means potentially the traumatizing narcissist. The distinction I make here is this, that not all grandiose, inflated narcissists remain fixed in that position. Many people like that will flip-flop between inflation and deflation. And when we say pathological narcissist, we're often talking about that person whose grandiosity is kind of undergirded with a whole lot of insecurity, and whose insecurity is undergirded by a whole lot of grandiosity. That more or less defines, in an oversimplified way, what we call the pathological narcissist. Why I call someone a traumatizing narcissist is that they remain almost entirely in the inflated position, and they do so by developing relationships in which they can deflate the other. So their inflation depends on their ability to keep others deflated. And those people who get into those relationships as the subjugated ones are very much like Fromm's people, looking to find the antidote to a sense of powerlessness, to a sense of weakness. This is why cults prey on college students. College students are at a transitional point in their lives between childhood and adulthood. Many of them are anxious about the future, are uncertain about the future. Many of them are questioning, how will they stand up in the world and compete against others in the world and in the job market and so on. And they're vulnerable. They're vulnerable about who they are. And cults are very successful on college campuses because they get people right at that transitional place where they're searching for something. They're looking for an ideal. They're looking for mentors. They're looking for, guidance. Maybe they haven't felt that they get it as strongly as they would have liked in their families. Well, the cults walk in and provide it, and they're very seductive and very successful. But individuals can behave in the same way. I'm seeing somebody who I'll work hard at disguising, but who would not be known. This is not somebody in the profession, certainly, who was in a coffee shop and started chatting with a guy. And the guy claimed to be a shaman and claimed to have led several other followers to enlightenment. He was a musician. He was just a regular guy in a coffee shop. But this woman became completely enthralled to him and allowed him to behave to her in extremely abusive ways, physically violent and sexually abusive, for a period of 9 months before she absolutely cut herself off. And the aftermath for her has been, incredible episodes of dissociation, panic, tremendous amount of panic, anxiety. And, we're working through all of that. But this is just a person, one person, seducing and recruiting one other person into this system of subjugation. This is actually among people who work in the field of cults as experts in helping people with post-cult trauma. We're seeing this more and more these days, these one-on-one situations of some Svengali-like person just mesmerizing another person, and then that mesmerized person eventually breaks loose and is astonished that they would have allowed themselves to be subjugated in that way. It's very common now.
It is. I've actually, as you were talking, I realized I've had several patients myself in similar situations. One person was working in a store, and some fellow came in, and next thing you know, she's living with him and two other people or whatever in this house, and she had to break away from it. But it was almost like hypnotic or, so seductive she couldn't – she almost had no
– Yeah, and I've been talking to more than one person who has been in a large corporation where a senior supervisor or executive gains control over a group of employees and creates a kind of separate harem basically as a mentor and a spiritual guide and a guru to these other employees. I've heard about this in some of the big companies and big industries. And I've heard about it for years because I've been working in this area for more than 20 years now. But it seems to be even more common than ever now, this situation of the one-on-one cultic dynamic, which basically is the relational system of the traumatizing narcissist.
Well, maybe in the time that we have left, we can kind of segue naturally into what that means for in our profession and maybe in institutes or training, if you have any thoughts about those particular settings.
Well, I did want to, when I spoke about the Sullivan Institute in the book, I wanted to be clear that the problem of controlling narcissistic therapists has been with us all along since the beginning. Certainly it was a problem in Freud's time. Many people feel that Freud himself was more narcissistic than was good for him in that he was unable to tolerate the separate development and maturation of his disciples. As soon as they differed from him in any way, they tended to get exiled and excommunicated. Violating therapists are studied very, very well by Andrea Salenza and Glenn Gabbard and others. And I've worked with many people who have come in and told me about a previous therapy in which they were profoundly controlled in a very microscopic way by the therapist. Some really horrific tales where the therapist believes that they're so brilliant and so righteous that they have no boundaries that need to be respected and no ethical norms that they need to consider because they're completely above that. And they're able to really financially and sexually and emotionally control sometimes large groups of patients. There's quite a few situations like that in our profession as we speak, and they go largely unnoticed.
Well, I was thinking of the examples of Eugene Landy. I think it was Eugene Landy who worked with Brian Wilson, and also in the film Some Kind of Monster, where the therapist moved in, you know, and how we're kind of enthralled by it at the same time repulsed, you know, that there's an interest.
Yes,
in
it's true. That is a character also Running with Scissors portrayed a character like that. And there have been many others in films. And, so there's that. And then there's the training situation where candidates are supervised. And I devoted a chapter to that situation. Taking the risk of giving some examples in my own training of what I felt was narcissistic behavior on the part of supervisors. And it's not that this hasn't been thought about or talked about, but the truth is the literature focuses a lot more on the narcissism of candidates than it does on the narcissism of supervisors or training analysts, which I think is unfortunate.
Interesting, right?
Because candidates are in a situation where if they're not happy with the training analyst or with the supervisor, it's the power dynamic is such that the candidate can easily be labeled too narcissistic and be coerced basically into accepting that there's the only pathology is theirs. And the truth is that supervisors and training analysts can be narcissistic as much as anybody else. I think everybody who's been around long enough pretty much knows that. I'll put it that way. However, there's a difference. I want to talk about a slight difference between somebody who's just sort of narcissistic and somebody who's a traumatizing narcissist. So maybe the best way I can talk about that is in terms of an organization that has a goal in mind. Let's say somebody's running an organization that's meant to, raise money for, feeding the homeless. Okay. Well, somebody could set up that kind of an organization. Actually, an organization was developed by Werner Erhard back in the 70s called supposed to end world hunger. And, so somebody could set up that organization, and that could be the goal. And in one case, the person could be a very charismatic and narcissistic leader, and a lot of money could be raised and a lot could be spent on feeding the homeless. In another example, the narcissistic, charismatic leader could set up that organization, and most of the money would be spent on him, not on the stated goal of the organization. So being narcissistic or charismatic doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to subjugate other people entirely for your own benefit. You can be quite a narcissistic person, but actually, actually run a group that actually achieves its goals. It's when the only real goal is the self-aggrandizement of the leader that's when you're looking at a traumatizing narcissist. Right.
Yes, there is healthy narcissism.
Absolutely. Look, I suddenly had the chance to write a book, and it's easy enough for me to sit there thinking I'm too stupid for anybody to want to read what I have to say. It's easy to go there. It's easy to say this isn't going to be good enough. I'm going to get, On the other hand, it's a little more difficult for me, but I had to do it to say, I'm going to say what I want to say. I'm going to say it how I want to say it. I'm going to actually be real about what's true for me. I'm going to write it out. And I'm going to put it out there. And maybe somebody will be interested. And you know, that was me having to pull my narcissism together enough to be able to feel like I could write a book that would be worth reading. Otherwise, what's the point of writing it, right? So, yes, you know, that kind of healthy narcissism is something I certainly recognize. And often with adult children of traumatizing narcissists, that's exactly what's missing for them, is the ability to own and claim their own, you know, their own talents and strengths and power. I work with a fellow who could be the guy who has it all, you know, the amazing education, the great looks, the athleticism, the intelligence, and the money. And he's one of the least entitled persons I've ever met. You know, basically because being raised by this very traumatizing narcissist, he was told, you know, don't be so grandiose, don't be so cocky, don't strut. And you know, he was diminished when he needed to simply be appreciated. And it's very hard for him now to own all of his strength and power, which and intelligence and talent. So, you know, yes, a traumatizing narcissist is not a healthy narcissist. It's a person who is trying to diminish someone else as a way of aggrandizing themselves.
Well, I think that that's a fitting place to end. I want to thank you for sharing with us today and kind of allowing me to be a little narcissistic with you and do this podcast,
right,
and so we can both be narcissistic for a moment. And but thanks a lot, Dan Shaw, for talking about your book, Traumatic Narcissism, Relational Systems of Subjugation. This has been Chris Bandini.
Thank you, Chris.
And this has been New Books in Psychoanalysis.